Welcome, everybody. This is the fourth office hours session, I believe, for Man Economy in the State, the Mises Economy or Mises Academy, and it's the second section of Man Economy in the State, going to the middle of the book. And we've got questions already coming out of the chute. And as usual, guys, for you who are signed in here watching this live, go ahead and just post your questions. Okay, Stephen Davis says, regarding present goods versus future goods, isn't this a very important distinction that can be objectively defined? Rothbard defines the interest rate as the price of present goods in relation to future goods. Money is still a good, even though it is a unique type of good. If I have money that is under my exclusive control, that money is a present good for me, and a present good for the person who controls it during that time. Isn't it critically important for Austrian business cycle theory that present and future goods be defined this way? Well, okay, let's start from scratch. I think the way that I would normally define present versus future goods is a present good is something that gives you enjoyments in the present, and the future good is something that's not going to yield enjoyments until the future. So, like, canonical or the epitome of present and future good, like an apple in your hand right now, assuming you intend to eat it, is a present good, whereas an apple seed would be a future good. So it is a good, it's scarce, it has a means of, or it can satisfy your wants, but it's a future good because, you know, you gotta plant the thing, get the apples. So I think that's the way you normally would frame it. So money, like you say, is a little bit tricky. For sure, Mises and Rothbard classify money as a present good. Right? You know, Rothbard does that explicitly in Man, Economy, and State. I think he calls it the present good extraordinaire or par excellence or something, you know, some flourish like that. And Mises, even in Theory of Money and Credit, I remember in certain passages, talks about money being a present good, because when he's talking about fiduciary media, he says that the thing with fiduciary media is you can give somebody else purchasing power without giving a present good, whereas if it's a loan that doesn't involve fiduciary media, then one party gives up present goods in exchange for future goods. So I think you're right. Certainly, the standard Austrian way of thinking about it, that's this distinction between present and future goods is used. And I'm trying to just relate it to Austrian business cycle theory. It certainly would have to be involved with that, because otherwise the theory wouldn't make any sense. The distinction between, I mean, certainly for Austrian business cycle theory, you need the distinction between present and future goods. And, like, how do you classify money? The reason I'm personally stumbling over dealing with money is I'm having this argument on my blog the last few months. Is this issue of, like, can you treat cash as part of your savings? And it's kind of a tricky thing to classify, because the reason we say money is a present good is that you can use it to obtain present goods. You can use money to consume right away. And if you're going to engage in a legitimate loan, you're not involving fraction reserve banking, but just I'm going to lend you $1,000, and next year you're going to give me back $1,100. Usually, the way we classify that is we say that I'm giving you present goods and you're giving me a future good. You know, you're giving me this promise that you're going to pay me back $1,100 in the future. But strictly speaking, if I gave you that $1,000 and you didn't go, the reason we think it's a present good is because we assume normally you're going to take the $1,000 and go do something with it. Like, you're either going to buy consumption goods or you're going to invest in your business or whatever. But strictly speaking, what if you didn't do that? Or forget the loan application, but just say, you know, I earn $10,000 from my job, and I spent $9,000 of it, and then the remaining $1,000, I don't use it to go buy a bond. Let me do it that way. Suppose I earn $10,000 in a month. My employer pays me in cash, let's say. I spend $9,000 of it on my rent and groceries and gas and whatever. And then the remaining $1,000, if I took it and bought a bond that yielded 1% over the next 12 months, we would all agree that I purchased a future good with it. That bond was a future good because I was taking that income and devoting it to future enjoyments. But if I took that surplus $1,000, you know, the amount that I saved, and I just added it to my cash balances because maybe I'm just real uncertain about the future and the 1% interest rate, you know, isn't a big deal to me. And I didn't spend the $1,000 that whole year, and I was subjectively, you know, in my plans, allocating it for future use. It seems a little bit weird to me to say that was a present good. Whereas if I had taken $1,000 and converted it into a bond, that's a future good. So that's what I'm saying. Money's kind of tricky because holding it gives you services, right? So it's you get a yield from just holding money in the present. So in that sense, it's a present. Even if you don't spend it, it's a present good because it's giving you its services just by you possessing it. But on the other hand, there's a sense in which if you're trying to tie it to the consumption of other goods and services, there's a sense in which money is kind of like a future good, or it can be. So that's the reason I was saying it. It's a little bit tricky. All right, Steven says, yes, I'm aware of the argument. The money thing shouldn't be so confusing in my eyes. Money is a good. It doesn't matter that I'm saving it for exchange later. It's a good that I'm holding now. Well, right, but a bond is a good that I'm holding right now. But yet we call it a future good, or you know, the apple seed, or a capital good I hold right now. But we call it a future good. So why are we doing that? And I'm saying because we're subjectively it's not yielding its consumption for us until the future. So even the capital good, you know, it's not, if we have a factor of production, we're using it now. So whatever the thing physically does for us technologically, we're doing it right now. It's not that we let it sit in the factory for a year and then activate it a year later. No, it's doing whatever its thing is right now. The reason we call it a future good is that it doesn't yield its, you know, the thing that it's going to do for us isn't going to actually yield consumption, you know, an increase in consumption goods until the future. So that's what I'm saying. If that's the criterion we're using for everything else, it's a little bit, it just seems weird to me with money that even if it's going to yield consumption of other goods and services not until the future, that we're calling a present good. But again, that's just me musing on stuff. That's not, I don't know any Austrians who've written that up. Okay, Benjamin says, what will be the reading list for the sovereign debt class? Students can't know what it is until they enroll. Well, we don't have the reading list yet because this is such a thing we're putting together so quickly. So it's not that we're hiding the list, it's that the list doesn't exist yet. Next week, I'm going to have a Mises.org article, like an infomercial for the class, and so we'll have the reading list by then. So so my point is, if you're interested but you want to see what the thing's going to be, don't enroll yet. You'll be able to see it before you have to enroll. Okay, Benjamin says, he's quoting Ms. Shedlock. Austrian economist as well as hyperinflationist with myopic eyes focus solely on money supply instead of debt, and everybody with ill-conceived notions of the power of the Fed better figure out that out in a hurry, or they risk more horribly blown macro calls. Mish Sedlock on August 11th, 2011. And then he said, and then, who's this Benjamin? Yeah, and then Benjamin says, after quoting Mish, can you discuss your current position about debt deflation? Mish maintains that debt deflation will prevent the Fed from creating hyperinflation. What about the Bernanke monetization? Debt money is being spent by the government. Since hyperinflation starts in the currency markets, what effect will today's worldwide money printing have on Bernanke's ability to inflate? How about the dollar's decline against the basket of commodities that is often ignored? Okay, well, I haven't read that particular Mish article. I mean, I've read his other stuff, but this one's more recent. So, you know, I'll have to look at that. I assume, Benjamin, that you posted this in the forum, so if you posted it there, I'll catch up. You know, I'll read Mish's thing, and then if I have something more specific to say, I'll post it there. The thing with Mish, and everybody does this, like, people throw out a lot of predictions over time, and then later the stuff that they got right, that's what they focus on, and they don't look at the predictions they said that were wrong. And so, I mean, I think you probably read, Benjamin, like, I did go through and show that Mish was not expecting commodities to go up as much as they did. So, you know, he is patting himself on the back saying, yep, I knew there wasn't going to be this massive inflation, and guys like Peter Schiff were totally wrong. And, you know, guys like Bob Murphy, if he read my stuff, would say, oh, these guys were wrong, because Mish knew about the debt deflation aspect of it, and so that's why I got everything right. But, you know, you go through his stuff starting in early 2008, and he did not realize that oil was going to double. Because remember, oil had fallen to like 30 in the 30s by December of 08. So if you go to Mish in January of 09, I meant to say. So, and I went through and showed, even as the oil boom was developing, that, you know, in going through that from various dates, Mish kept thinking, okay, this oil can't go any higher, because in his mind, we're in a deflationary process here, so why would oil keep going up? But it did keep going up. So that's what I mean, that it's certainly true that consumer prices have not gone up the way I thought they were going to, and so I am revising the way I look at these things to try to figure out, well, why did that happen like that? How come all prices didn't go up? And so my, I know I've said this before, just repeating it, right now my fallback position is that, well, it might just be an issue of aggregation, and that if Bernanke's shoveling $1 trillion in the pipeline on one end, that, you know, those rich investment bankers getting that money aren't going to go to this grocery store and buy a bunch of eggs with it. They're going to go, you know, put their money in places where they think it's going to be shielded from price inflation. And so you would see stocks go up. You would see gold and silver go up. Commodities in general could go up. So that's, but you wouldn't necessarily see consumer prices, because that would be pretty tame, at least for a while, just because some unemployment's so high and the average person is deeply in debt, underwater on their house, that kind of thing. So that's, but I certainly didn't call that beforehand. No, when I saw how much money Bernanke was creating, I just sort of naively thought, yeah, you're going to see price inflation, without being real specific about where is it going to hit, and maybe it's going to take a long time to filter through. I mean, so just because people are unemployed and whatever, that doesn't guarantee you're not going to see prices at the grocery store go up, because, you know, if input prices triple, well, producers, they can't just keep, you know, they have to do something about that. Their profitability gets hit. So I'm not saying that it's going to prevent it from happening, but I can see how things had played out and that was like definitely a damping force on it. And you're right, this is Benjamin, you're right, Benjamin, that I think, you know, it would be in the currency market. So what I'm not predicting this will happen, but it wouldn't stun me if just one day we wake up and the dollar falls against other currencies like by, you know, 20%, just boom, right out of the chute, and, you know, the dollar just crashes. So it wouldn't be that. It wouldn't be that all the prices at the mall go up by 80% in one day. You know, at first, like if a hyperinflation developed, eventually that would be the case. What I'm saying, it's not like everything would be normal, and then all of a sudden you go to the store and everything costs twice as much. That wouldn't happen, but it is possible that just one day out of the clear blue sky, the dollar falls 50% against other major currencies. Excuse me. Because, you know, how would that happen? There could be, you know, I just to give a specific example, I've said this before, that it could be something innocuous, like a Chinese bank of, you know, Bank of China official or Chinese central bank official saying something that, you know, trying to say, oh, we're going to slow the rate of our purchases of treasuries, but he's speaking, you know, and it gets mistranslated. And then people think he said, we're going to start selling treasuries or something like that. And, you know, I could see that sparking a panic and then the dollar just crashing. Just like what's been happening with the stock market lately. Like there's no reason the stock market should have fallen 4% or whatever last Thursday, and that it should have fallen 5% on Monday, and then, you know, then zoom back up and then zoom back down, and having the yo-yo ride that it had this last week. When I say there's no reason, I mean it's not like some bit of news would have made all the investors rerun their numbers and say, oops, the optimal price for these stocks is actually now 4% less than what we thought yesterday because of this new information. So therefore, I'm going to adjust my holding, and the new equilibrium price is going to be 4%. That's not what happened. So I thought the market was overvalued because of all Bernanke stuff, and so it didn't surprise me that it fell. But my point is, once you're in like a bubble situation, what would make it pop? It's, you know, it could be something silly. And so by the same token, if treasuries right now are in a bubble, and I think they are, then it's, why would they stop being in a bubble? I don't know. But my point is just, if they are in a bubble, any little thing could make them pop. And because I think once they start falling, they're going to fall hard. But yeah, I'll check out Mish's thing, Benjamin. If you haven't already, if you can post it in the various questions for the professor, because I'll go through today and make sure I'm up to speed on that. Okay, you guys got other? And Benjamin, if I'm not answering your question, if you want me to talk about something else more specifically, just you can post that again because we've got time. But I'm not sure exactly what you wanted to discuss there. Okay, Lewis says, Dr. Murphy, at the current rate, should we expect the price of gold to zoom up past $2,000 soon? Well, I mean, I could be really silly and say, well, yeah, at the current rate it will, meaning if it goes up as much as it's gone up in the last 2 weeks, then, of course, just do the arithmetic. It'll pass $2,000, but does that assume that it will? So I'm guessing that's what you mean, that do I think it's going to do that anytime soon? I don't know. It's when I tell, like, my dad, for example, he has over, I think, like 10% or more of his portfolio is in a gold ETF, you know, because of my urging a while ago. And so certainly that's been helping him when his stocks are getting crushed, that he's got that gold component that's going up. And his broker always tells, you know, wants him to always sell that thing. Like, you know, every time gold hits a new high, his broker's like, all right, that's it. You know, just get out now because it's going to go down. And my dad always comes back to me and says, well, my guy says this. What do you think? And my position is always, well, yeah, it might go down next week, but the reason that you're holding that is are that it's like an insurance policy. In case the dollar absolutely crashes, you know, that's going to protect you somewhat, assuming Obama doesn't nationalize the gold ETFs, or assuming that the gold ETF actually has gold. And I, incidentally, I do tell him to also get the actual coins, not just to have it on paper. So, I mean, if I can reframe your question, for sure, I think within the next 5 years, well, yeah, within the next 5 years, gold will break 2,000, assuming Bernanke doesn't do something drastic or they don't bring another Fed chair who shrinks the monetary base. I think it will go above 2,000. What I am curious to see, though, and I'm not as sure, is are they going to do another round of asset purchases? That, you know, looking at that chart of the monetary base or looking at the chart of excess reserves, are they going to keep making that go up and up and up?
Excuse me.
Sorry, guys. I don't know. So before I thought they were, because before it looked like every time the economy hit a bump in the road, and that, well, actually not the economy, I should be more specific, every time the stock market hits a bump in the road and it looks like bank stocks are struggling, that Bernanke would just fire up the printing press, metaphorically. But last week, or a few days ago, they didn't explicitly promise to do that. And so I'm not, when I think they could have gotten away politically with doing it. So, you know, the public and the academics are urging them, you know, why doesn't Bernanke do more? Help us. Our stocks are getting crushed. So that kind of, you know, it's not that it shocked me. It's not that I was sure they were going to do QE3. I was curious to see what they were going to do, but I'm saying the fact that they didn't do QE3, at least at that point, didn't announce it, I'm not as sure what the heck they're doing. And it's, I don't know how many of you guys were on that conference call yesterday, or webinar, or whatever we called it. There, I just threw out the possibility, and again, I don't know this, I'm not inside their heads, so how can I know this, but before, I was trying to make sense of what the heck are they doing, because it sure looked like they were trying to destroy the dollar. You know, it looked like they were being very reckless, and so you wonder, is it just recklessness? Like, do they actually think they're helping? Not that they're trying to just, you know, help the average unemployed worker, but they're trying to bail out their buddies and stuff, and do they not realize they're playing with fire with what they've been doing and how this could really get out of control, and, you know, it could slip out of their hands very quickly. That's been my thing all along, that when Bernanke says on 60 Minutes, when the guy asked him, you know, well, how confident are you that you'd be able to turn this thing around if price inflation, he didn't say price, he said inflation, starts getting out of control, and Bernanke said, oh, I'm 100% confident. Or, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but Bernanke literally said he was 100% sure if he needed to, he could nip at the price inflation in the bud just by, you know, starting to suck reserves out of the system, raise interest rates, or pay higher interest rate on excess reserves. And that should terrify you if that's what he really believes, if he actually thinks that he has, you know, complete control over it, and there's no way it's going to get out of hand. So, anyway, I'm just sort of rambling at this point. My point was, back then, I thought, you know, when I was trying this to be real conspiratorial and say, what's the worst case scenario here, I entertained the hypothesis that maybe they're, you know, these international bankers and stuff who don't have loyalties to any particular country, maybe what their long-run plan is to get rid of the dollar and have a regional currency in North America, just like there's the euro, because there's various reasons that if you're going to have a printing press, the bigger the jurisdiction, the better you're off you are, right? It doesn't help you that much if you control the currency of Thailand or something, but if you control the Federal Reserve, that's a lot of power since so many people use dollars. And so by the same token, then if you can just expand that, and ultimately if there was just one world currency that was fiat and you controlled the printing press for that thing, you would have, you know, huge power because nobody could flee from your currency. People would just have to go back to barter if they didn't want to use your currency. So you'd have a lot more room to inflate. So anyway, back a few months ago or last year, you know, that was my sort of dark hypothesis as to, well, that would make sense of everything that's going on, where Bernanke is doing stuff that in my mind is very reckless and is, you know, extremely risky, and but yet he keeps giving all these official rationalizations for why they're doing it. And then I thought, oh, so that way if it did get out of hand, it wouldn't look like it was deliberate. It would just look like, oh my gosh, you know, we unwittingly set up the dollar to collapse. Who could have predicted that would happen? And so it would just be looked at, it would just, like, the public would just feel like they were getting carried along a stream. And, oh, okay, now we're using the Omero. We used to use the dollar, but back in 2013, the dollar crashed, and the government and the Fed came in and to help us deal with that crisis. They replaced the dollar with the Omero, which was much more stable. You know what I'm saying? But now it looks like they're not doing that. Like, the Fed is very reluctant to inflate more, even though everybody's demanding that they do it. So it's odd. In other words, you would think, because before, the Fed was doing all kinds of stuff, even though it was getting people mad. You know, people didn't want the Fed inflating and bailing out bankers and stuff behind the scenes, and Bernanke was just, you know, being a wall of silence on that when Congress was trotting him out and things like that. And he was saying, well, it would defeat the purpose of the program if I told you who we gave the money to, that kind of stuff. So back then, you know, he was, in a sense, defying the public by inflating, and everyone was looking at those charts and freaking out. And, you know, Glenn Beck had on his show and was making like an Al Gore CO2 chart, except it was the monetary base or the excess reserves. But now it's flipped. Now people are saying, Bernanke, please print more dollars, and he's not doing it, or he's not doing it as much as they want. So it seems like something has changed, and again, you know, this is totally, you know, off the wall speculation, but I was wondering, well, maybe they're seeing what's happening in the Eurozone and how the Euro might collapse, and so maybe they're like, you know what, let's hold off for a minute, let's not destroy the dollar, because we have to, you know, the Euro situation is not, you know, it looks like the Euro might collapse, that some countries might go off of it, and so. So if that were happening, so in other words, suppose for a second that my crazy conspiracy theory was true, you could see how people doing that, seeing what's going on in Europe right now, might be like, oh, wait a minute, let's hold off on that. And so, anyway, that's, but of course, what evidence do I have for any of this? None. Just that I think certain people would benefit. Even some people did establish the Euro for a reason. And I don't think it was just out of altruism. They wanted to just had the welfare of the European people in their hearts. So, but Lewis, to answer your question, I think it was a long answer to your question. Yeah, the only way I would see gold not going above 2,000 is if Bernanke or whoever the Fed chair is starts selling assets off and shrinking the balance sheet. And I can't imagine them doing that anytime soon. And I think it would take, like, what would make them do it is if there were a crisis that the dollar starts crashing or, you know, price inflation starts really getting into double digits and stuff, in which case you would think, you know, gold would go above 2,000. So I would be very surprised if within the next 5 years if gold doesn't break 2,000. But is it going to do it next week? I don't know. I mean, gold could fall several hundred dollars an ounce over the next couple months. Like that's entirely possible in my mind. But I don't think it's going to go down and stay down. I think it's just going to bounce around because people are freaking out. They don't know what's going on. Okay, Benjamin says, Keynesians don't like to mention the side effects of their religion, mainly government deficits turning into mountains of unsustainable debt and defrauding savers and fixed income people of their standard of living. Why did they get away with this? Do you see any way the USA can ever pay its debt without inflating it away? I wonder why the organizations for the retired are so silent on Bernanke's zero interest rate policy and his money printing.
Excuse me.
You know, that's a good question about the last thing you said there. I'm trying to think if any of these groups. Well, I think part of it is, my understanding is that like the AARP, American, I don't know what the first A stands for, but Association of Retired People, the big lobby group that always opposes cuts in Social Security benefits and that kind of stuff. I think if you had to classify them, they tend to be fairly liberal in the modern American sense, like left wing. So it could just be something as simple as that you know, concern over sound money and interest rates not being too low is something that right-wingers care about, and that's like a Ron Paul kind of thing, and the AARP wouldn't be associated with that. You're right, though. I have not really, and that's the funny thing is, when people talk about monetary policy, the only thing they ever talk about in terms of what you're saying is that, oh, if people are on fixed income and then prices are rising, that hurts them. And so that would be the angle through which they might say that Bernanke's policies are hurting retired people. But you're right, they don't. I mean, I guess, well, no. I was going to say I have read people saying occasionally what you're talking about, but it's always been like Lou Rockwell or somebody. It's not a non-Austrian writer mentioning that fact that when interest rates are at rock bottom levels, if you're trying to live off of, you know, if you have a nest egg that you're living off of, that it's tough to do that without taking on risk. And I have seen people say, criticize low interest rates from that angle, like mainstream economists, Chicago School kind of guys, saying that during the housing boom years, what happened is when Greenspan Well, can you guys hear me right now? So what's, can you just diagnose what's going on? Okay, you can hear me, but you still can't see me? Okay. Yeah, because the camera just disappeared. Hang on a second. Let me see if I can. Okay, I'm back. All right. That was weird. Like, just disappeared. All right. Okay, great. So, who asked me that? Okay, so Benjamin, you're right. I'm agreeing with you. I don't have a good answer for you, but I'm agreeing that. Well, I think it's, to be frank, I think it's that the Austrians are the only school of thought that even cares about interest rates, in the sense of how does it affect specific sectors. That even, you know, Chicago School economists also, in their standard models, they don't have anything remotely like the structure of production in the Austrian tradition. And so the idea of saying, I mean, okay, but here's a way to put it. I think most economists, like the general public, sort of think that other things equal, low interest rates are good. That means, you know, it's people can spend more and there's more investment, and without and they don't make the connection about, well, no, a low interest rate, if it's the false price, if there really aren't those savings available, or, you know, for whatever reason the market interest rate would be low, if those conditions really aren't there, a low interest rate is bad. It screws things up. Just like to have $5 a barrel oil isn't good if that's not really the true scarcity. So I think that's part of it, perhaps, that people don't even make the connection about low interest rates and how that's hurting the ability of retired people to, you know, earn a living off of the yield from their principal. And then you also had said, Benjamin, that Keynesians don't like to mention the side effects of their religion. How do they get away with it? Well, I can say some things to you that we all know are true, but it's not really a good explanation. I mean, I'm still amazed how did the president get away with the situation in Libya? You know, I'm going off on a tangent here, but they said they were gonna, like, the statutory authorization under which the U.S. sent military forces into Libya, it was like he had 30 days or something like that. You know, I'm forgetting the specifics at this point, but whatever thing they cited as to why he had the authority to send troops in, or, you know, send in combat forces without getting congressional approval or input, was that, you know, there's some things saying that he can do a 30-day or 1 month, whatever the thing was, engagement. You know, the purpose of that was like to fend off an imminent attack. It certainly was not to go protect civilians from being harmed by their brutal dictator in some far off land. But the point is, ignore that. The thing said he had 30 days, and of course now that's much past 30 days since U.S. troops have been deployed to Libya, and yet that's, or not, you know, not U.S. troops, you know what I'm saying? So it's, how do you get away with it? Well, people don't care. They have short attention spans, and I think they just, with a lot of this stuff, I mean, if you are a libertarian, anarcho-capitalist, you know, the Rothbardian persuasion, it's not just that you disagree with the policy that the government's doing, you think they're actually criminal. And so with a lot of this stuff, you say, well, how come no one else is seeing it like I do? You know, how can you guys just sit there and let the government get away with this stuff? Or another one was Waco. I mean, that was, I don't know, some of you guys might be too young to remember that, but there it was under Bill Clinton, his attorney. There was, you know, David Koresh was this religious zealot, and, you know, there were all these accusations that he had this compound in Waco, Texas, and there's accusations that there was child abuse going on in there and stuff. And so they surrounded it, and they first the BATF went in, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and the Branch Davidians, the people that were living this thing, like, fought them off with guns, right? The BATF, you know, just marched in there, and then they were outgunned, and they left. Or I don't know if they're outgunned, but they didn't want to die. Like, I feel like these people are shooting back at us. And so then they just sent in the SWAT teams and tanks and everything, and they shot in tear gas and used chemical weapons that were banned under international treaties and stuff. Like, it would have been a war crime to use that stuff against a foreign army, but they used it against these U.S. civilians. And, you know, and then what happened, of course, is all the all the kids got burned up in the raid that was allegedly to save the kids from child abuse. And I mean, I'm still surprised that nothing happened. Janet Reno didn't even have to resign. She said, "Oh, I take full responsibility." She was the person nominally in charge of that in the Clinton administration. And she said, you know, "Oh, I take full responsibility for that." And then nothing happened to her. I was like, okay, you took full responsibility for burning a bunch of kids alive, literally, and you don't even have to quit your job. You still get paychecks. Are you kidding me? So, yeah, I don't know what to tell you why that happened. One reason is, if it's that extreme, the stuff your government is doing is that extreme, it's not just, oh, well, the next election, I better vote for somebody else. I mean, the way we're brought up, like, you know, we studied Nazi Germany and stuff, and, oh, just following orders is not a valid thing. And, you know, I was certainly raised, like, oh, what were those apathetic German citizens doing? Like, how could they just sit back and let their government do the horrible things? Those were bad people. And you're brought up with that kind of mentality. And so on the one hand, that's good, because it's correct that, yeah, what the heck were the German people doing when the Nazi party was doing all that stuff? But on the other hand, it's sort of paralyzing because people are afraid to do that. You know, it wasn't the hassle. If you discover one day that, you know, you used to be a good citizen and think that your government was doing what it could to bring freedom and democracy around the world, and then you wake up and realize, you know, there's a legitimate sense in which the United States is actually kind of a bully. And it just goes into countries and blows them up and takes over and puts in puppet governments that serve its interests. Huh, that's kind of weird. I mean, you would have to do something. You know, you couldn't just go back to watching football. You'd have to, you know, who knows what, but you'd have to do something about it. And so I think that's part of the reason people don't believe it. You know, I've talked to people and they've literally said to me something like, well, I just refuse to believe that our government officials are that evil, Bob. You know, like the same thing with that kind of tone that, oh, come on, you're saying that they're actually evil. You're not just saying that they made a mistake. And it's like, well, how else would you explain what's going on? You know, that kind of thing. So as far as the Keynesian stuff, I think that's part of it, that if we're right, it's not simply that, you know, all those government officials are just, oops, they made a tactical mistake, and they were looking at the ISLN diagram when they should have been looking at the Hayekian triangle, and it was an honest mistake, and they're doing their best. You know, that's not what we think. And so it's kind of hard to get other people to see it like that, because then, like, that would change their lives. It's sort of like, you know, you mentioned the word religion, and it's kind of like, if somebody that likes to go out to parties and sleep around and stuff, and he's, you know, does cocaine every weekend or something, you know, and he's a kind of an agnostic, and he's like, oh, I don't really think about that stuff. I don't know if maybe there's a higher power, who knows. It would be hard to get him to be a born-again Christian besides, you know, the extraordinary claims that are made on behalf of that faith, but also, well, he would have to change his lifestyle. Right, because he would just know, well, I can't keep doing this stuff because the other born-again Christians are going to think, you know, that I'm not living properly. And so I mean, it's that kind of thing where if you kind of like being an American and you think that the American troops are, you know, the vanguard of liberty for people, oppressed people around the world and that kind of thing, and your government is the one government in human history that's actually good, and every other government you know can be corrupt, but not the American government. No, U.S. officials never do bad stuff. Then it it's hard to get you to think that. So the same thing with the Keynesian stuff. I mean, if you and I are right in the way we look at the world, I mean, it's like the Matrix. You know what I mean? Like, it's scary, and some people don't want to take that pill. I forget which pill it is. I forget, is it the red pill? So I think that's part of it. And also, Benjamin, too, one last thing. It's economics is hard. You know, it's not as hard as they try to make it in undergrad courses with all the curves and everything. And, you know, we can talk about that maybe some other time, that I actually think that that's almost intentional, that they want people to not understand economics, and that's why it's so stultifying. They want everyone to think that this is an impossible subject. I'm too stupid. I don't understand it. I'll leave it to the experts, because I tried to take economics in college, and it didn't make any sense to me. I think the ruling powers like that mentality. But the Keynesians, it's hard stuff. And also, superficially, it kind of makes sense, doesn't it? That, well, yeah, the reason we're in a slump right now is no one's buying anything. So, yeah, you just got to get people to go spend more. And there is, I mean, you got guys like Krugman. I mean, he is a sharp guy, and he's very persuasive. You know, that's probably why I'm addicted to his blog. Is he really puts up a solid defense of Keynesianism. All right, I think he's wrong, and I can go through and put it, but I'm saying it's like he puts on a show, and I totally get why so many of his, why he has such a big following, and I totally get how if you're politics or ideology or just you're by your nature, you had no problem with government intervention. You mistrusted or distrusted businesses, big business and stuff like that. Like that was the bad guy that you saw in the world. Right? Because I think when Rothbardians, when we look out at the world, we see criminal governments doing evil things to people. Like that's what we notice. Whereas when a lot of Keynesians, and I don't mean like the professional economist, I mean like the average person who subscribes to Keynesian economics, when they look out at the world, they see like pockets of wealth, you know, concentrated wealth and privilege, and then homelessness, and they think that's unfair. Or they see, you know, women not getting promoted because of sexism in the workplace and that kind of, you know, I mean, those are the injustices that jump out at them. Or they, you know, read about accounting scandals, oh my gosh, and they read about the corruption on Wall Street, and that's the stuff that for them cries out for justice. They don't notice the stuff that the governments are doing. Like that, I mean, they can be aware of it, but to them that's not the pressing, burning social issue that needs to be. And also, Benjamin, when you're talking about the debt, I mean, Krugman is a master in making it look like, I mean, he has convinced people that Obama's not a big spender. He does all these tricks. Like, he'll show you the graph of government spending going through the roof, which it has under Obama. And then Krugman will do all these tricks to make it look like, no, actually government spending is below where it should be. You know, because he'll say stuff like, oh, well, it's just the automatic social safety net things and tax revenues are down, so that's part of the reason the deficit's so big, blah, blah, blah. And by the end of his little demonstration, you're thinking that, you know, Obama is like Ron Paul or something. And so I'm just saying, it's since we know he's totally wrong, we can sit back dispassionately and point out where he's putting the rabbit into the hat and his little magic trick. But I'm saying if you already tended to agree with him, you would, you know, he would solidify your views. You can keep walking away from his columns week after week thinking, yep, I'm right. I mean, that's the thing is, they make jokes about, when I say they, I mean like American liberals in the modern sense. They make jokes about, are we frozen again? So, okay, all right, sorry. So they, you know, they make jokes about how, oh yeah, the media, or sorry, reality has a liberal bias, you know, because they're making fun of conservatives who complain that the media has a liberal bias. Because that was the like the justification for Fox News, and that's why so many conservatives liked Fox when Fox News came on the scene, is because before then, all the news truly was from a liberal perspective. The, you know, all the news stories and everything were always about evil businessmen, and anytime politics were involved, the Democrat politicians were cast in a favorable light, and the Republicans were cast as, you know, heartless people who just liked the rich and wanted to kill grandma. And so now, like, the liberals, like, they're, to make fun of that, they say stuff like, oh, too bad reality has a liberal bias. Like, they're saying, like, the conservatives don't like facts. So, and there is, and like, that stuff with climate change and all that. I mean, there is a sense in which the Keynesians think, well they're in the mainstream. Right, they control. I mean, just think on paper. If you didn't know anything about economics, and you've got the Nobel Prize winner Paul Krugman and all of the other top guys from the Ivy League, you know, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, whatever, those guys are all Keynesians. Like, even Greg Mankiw, who's supposed to be a conservative, and he's a Keynesian. He's a new Keynesian. He says he is. I'm not casting aspersions on him. He says he's a new Keynesian. So those guys are all Keynesians. And then you got these fringe guys who hang out in Auburn, Alabama, and some of them, like this guy Murphy, doesn't even have a teaching position anywhere. And when he did teach, he was at some podunk school, Hillsdale College, this little dinky school in Michigan. What the heck is that? Right? So on paper, why wouldn't they think that they were right? You see what I'm saying? So, well, where I was going with that thing with the debt is that Krugman has these mental gymnastics where he goes through and makes it look like the debt situation is fine. Like, all it would take would be raising taxes on upper income earners, and we'd be fine. You know, that the real such a problem with our debt is future Medicare and Social Security obligations, mostly Medicare. And so we just need to put in, you know, so for Krugman, it's a healthcare reform is the way to deal with our debt problem. You know, so he'll be able to put arguments up like that to make it look like the Republicans are nuts. I mean, Krugman, I'm not putting words in his mouth. He's literally said that $1 trillion right now is nothing. You know, trillion here, trillion there, absolutely nothing. Whether our debt right now is $14.3 trillion or $15 trillion or $16 trillion, that's a drop in the bucket compared to, you know, like long-term projections and you know how much extra in interest costs would that mean for the taxpayers? It's nothing. It's a rounding error. The real thing for Krugman is if you want to get the debt situation under control, we have to stop rising health care costs, and that's why we need health reform, and we need to have, you know, like a single payer or whatever, and the Republicans are blocking that. Right? So, I mean, that's the thing. He'll take the issue and flip it on its head so that, yeah, if you guys are concerned about the debt, or they'll say the way we get out of the debt situation is to fix the economy. And so if you're a Keynesian and you believe the problem is insufficient demand, he's going to say it's penny-wise and pound-foolish to cut spending now to try to save money and help the budget, the federal budget, because that's just going to prolong the recession, drive up unemployment, so you're going to have less tax revenue. Right, so Krugman made arguments like that. So I'm just trying to get you, Benjamin, to, like, because you asked me, you know, how do they get away with it? I'm explaining that's the kind of stuff they do. Okay, Stephen Davis is still pulling his hair out. He does not like my slipperiness. He says, this present versus future goods thing is killing me. Aren't you basically saying that these items, that these terms are not objectively definable? Isn't that problematic? I think holding a bond that matures on a set future date is easily distinguished from holding money itself. DeSoto's discussion of interest rates relies heavily on this distinction, just like Rothbard's. If you think present versus future goods is a tricky distinction, how do you reconcile that with your acceptance of their definitions of the interest rate and the implications for ABCP? Okay, and then, all right, so Stephen asked that, and then he's got another question up, and that's probably going to take us past the time. So if any of you had, like, some burning quick thing, go ahead and post it, and I'll do that now. But absent seeing any new posts, I'll wrap up with answering Stephen here and then the second question he asked about Keynesians. Okay, Stephen, so, well, what do you mean by objectively definable? So you, the terms are definable, sure, and that's objective, but then how do you apply it? Because, like, for example, is a particular item a capital good or a consumption good? We can define what those terms mean, but we don't know what it is until we know what the subjective plan is of the owner, right? So, like the example I would use at Mises U is, there's a guy on the street corner strumming his guitar. What is that? Is the guitar a capital or a consumption good? Well, if he's just playing it for his own enjoyment, it's a consumption good. But then people are walking by, they like the music, they start throwing money into his hat. Now it turns in, and he thinks, oh, I can use this thing to raise revenue. That's cool. And then he starts doing it that way, and that's how he's intentionally using it. Then it's all of a sudden it's a capital good. You know, now it's a tool in his business of providing musical services to people. It's not just something he plays for his own enjoyment. So it's the same physical guitar being used for what looks to be the same thing, but all of a sudden now the classification changes. All right, so. And it's not due to some intrinsic property of the guitar. It depends on the person using it. What role is it serving? It's a subjective thing, whether it's a capital or a consumption good. So for present and future goods, yeah, you're totally right. That's, you need that distinction for Austrian business cycle theory, because what happens in the unsustainable boom in Austrian business cycle theory is people are trying to, start long-term processes for which there's not enough real savings. I think you're right that you do need to make the distinction between present and future goods. I had to think for a minute about exactly where that distinction comes into the argument, but I agree with you that you need that distinction. I'm not going to argue with you on that point. But what I'm saying is typically when you sit in a standard exposition, when you say that, what the capitalists do is they provide present goods to the workers in exchange for future goods, and that's the role of the capitalists, and that's what gets screwed up in Austrian business cycle theory. Yeah, I mean, usually you in practice, they do it in terms of money. It's not that the capitalists literally save up a bunch of tuna fish and clothes and have apartment buildings and then say to the workers, hey, you go work in my factory and then I'll let you live in this apartment that I own and I'll give you some tuna fish today and I'll give you some clothes and that kind of thing. No, they just give the workers money on the spot or with their paycheck every 2 weeks, whatever it is, and then the workers go buy the present goods. So their money is clearly being used as a present good because it gives command over what are clearly present goods. So I'm just repeating myself at this point, Steve, but I don't, if it wouldn't, let me put you this way. Whatever way we go with my, all right, I'll phrase it this way. If I ultimately convinced you that, yeah, I agree with Murphy, it's got to be the case that sometimes it makes sense to view money as a future good. I don't think Austrian business cycle theory would collapse because the way what would happen is, all right, here we go. I'm trying to think of the easiest way to get this across. You can still talk about the effects on real things, like real resources and so forth, even with the discussion of cash balances. So if everybody, let's say everybody in the community decides they want to save more, right? So in standard Austrian business cycle theory, or forget Austrian business cycle theory, just standard Austrian theory, like legitimate savings-based expansion, and we're almost out of time here, so I'll try to wrap this up and hit your other question really fast. what happens? Okay, so the community all of a sudden they decide to save more. So what, they spend less on consumption, and then let's say, oh, maybe they go and put the money in a bank, 100% reserve bank, and then the bank, you know, in a sense, they're lending the money to the bank, and then the bank lends it out to businesses, and then they go spend the money in the factor markets. And so the real resources that were released from producing consumption goods get reallocated to the higher stages, right? And the money just facilitates that because the consumers are spending less money on consumption goods, and then that money is getting spent by the producers on capital goods at the highest stages, right? So that's standard stuff, and it's all sustainable, great. But, so now, what if, for whatever reason, the people in this community, they don't trust the banks, or for whatever reason, and they still want to save more, though. Okay, they want to spend less on consumption, but the form that they want their savings to take now is not the savings account, like the CD that they bought from the bank, as it was in the first scenario, where they're literally handing over control of their cash to the bank and getting, you know, an IOU from the bank, which is clearly a future good. But now the household are saying, for whatever reason, no, we want to hold our purchasing power, hold our wealth, I should say, in the form of higher cash balances. We don't want to give it to a bank and lend it to a bank and then get an IOU. We want to just keep it as cash. So now everybody in the community, you know, gets their nominal paycheck to get paid in cash, but instead of going to the store and buying as many groceries and buying as many CDs or DVDs, whatever, they want to save that. So now what happens? So this is interesting because so my question is, from an individual household's perspective, you can see how that really shouldn't make that much of a difference, except for the interest rate. But if the interest rate is low, like if, you know, if the CD is yielding 1% a year, that's not that much interest that the household is losing. And so it's entirely plausible, especially like if they thought, oh, maybe the banks are going to fail or something, whatever the reason would be. But you can see how from an individual household's perspective, whether they had, like, you know, they lent $1,000 to the bank for a year for 1% interest, or they just added $1,000 to their house safe and it's just sitting in the safe in the vault, that's, from the household's perspective, you could see how those both be safe. And the advantage would be, you know, the cash is more liquid. If their plans change and they need to spend it next week, they can do that. So the question then is, well, what if everyone in the community decides to do that? Does that mean they're not really saving? Does that mean there's now not the ability for the economy to expand? And, you know, and I'm gonna do a blog post on it. I've just been so busy with my real work. I haven't had time to do this to explain this stuff, Stephen. But I think there's first of all, I think it's correct, but also I think I can show you in Mises and Human Action where he talks about this. That no, that is still saving and still releases real resources if they do that. So it's true, the community as a whole can't have higher cash balances because there's only so much cash in existence at any moment. But what happens is, if everyone in the community is trying to increase its cash balances by cutting back on consumption expenditures, that changes relative prices. So you see the prices of consumption goods go down, whereas the price of capital goods doesn't fall as much because, you know, where the cutbacks and expenditures are occurring are all on consumption goods, but by hypothesis. So the households, they're not putting more dollars into their vault, but the dollars they have in their vault now get higher and higher purchasing power because prices in general are dropping. And so the community can achieve its goal of having higher real cash balances because of prices going down, but beyond just that general, you know, macro thing, the individual sectors change. The sales in the consumption sector plummet because everyone's cutting back there. So they lay people off, and that frees up resources. And then the people at the higher stages, they can now bid those workers away, right? So wages fall more than they would have in the first scenario that I talked about. Okay, so the idea is you still, in real terms, it's still true if the household stops spending on consumption, that frees up real resources that then can get allocated elsewhere if the entrepreneurs know what's going on.
So my point is just, it's a little bit trickier to think through how it would manifest itself, but if people stop, if they cut back on their consumption spending, whether they save in the form of higher cash balances or attempted higher cash balances or by buying bonds or CDs from the bank, I think you still can tell the Austrian story of what happens with the structure of production. And so if you could see it in that case, then you could also see it in terms of Austrian business cycle theory if things get screwed up. Okay, real quick, Stephen says, but Stephen, I'll try to spell that out on my blog at some point. Like I said, I'm not going to be able to do it today because I have to catch up on the official stuff with you guys. And also, Stephen, just so everyone knows who's hearing this, I think what I'm saying is right, obviously, that's why I'm saying it, but like Joe Salerno has publicly disagreed with me a little bit on this. And there is parts in Man, Economy, and State, we're not going to get to it in this course, but in the next one, if you guys stick with me, where Rothbard attacks the Keynesian approach to cash balances and things. And so so I just want to acknowledge that. That what I'm saying here is my own view. I think it's the only way to reconcile all this stuff, but some Austrians might not agree with what I just said. But I think Mises would. Okay. So the last thing quickly, Stephen says, don't a lot of Keynesians claim that you can't demonstrate that inflation steals from people? Don't a lot of Keynesians claim that you can't demonstrate that inflation? How do they respond to the question of whether a counterfeiter steals from people? Yes, it may be difficult or impossible to trace the real effects, but clearly someone is winning and someone is losing, and real goods are being purchased, bid up in price, etc. You're right. They'll do stuff like, they hate when Ron Paul says the dollar has lost whatever the number is, like 96% or something of its purchasing power since 1913. As a critique of the Fed, they hate that kind of argument. They'll say, oh, but you know, wages have gone way up since then. So one thing to answer your question is they think a lot of the standard anti-inflation arguments are misleading. And then to get more sophisticated, because they're going to say just because what you guys are focusing on is the increase in the nominal price of goods and services, and you're acting as if wages didn't go up too, but wages go up too. So you're right. So Stephen says, right, what's the point of inflation then? I agree with you, and that's what I said in one of my Mises dailies on this a couple months ago, is it was that exact thing. I was defending Ron Paul's statement in those terms, saying, the basic stuff that you did, that clearly when they print money and give it to somebody, that person can acquire goods and services with it. So how is that, that redistributing property from one group to another? If they want to be real sophisticated, what a Keynesian or even quasi-monetarist could say in the present environment is that inflation doesn't have that problem because right now we have idle resources because of inadequate demand. And so if they inflate, and then that employs more people, it generates more total income, but there's more stuff to go around. So it doesn't make so they're going to say that they would say, you're locked into this mentality of thinking there's a fixed pie, and so if inflation gives some groups the ability to consume more, that means there's less for everybody else. And they would say, you're wrong for thinking that right now we have massive unemployment, idle resources galore, and inflation is one way, if done properly, that you could employ more people, so there's more stuff to go around. So it's still true you might have the redistribution, but it's a redistribution of a bigger pie, and so on average, everyone's richer. If they want to be sophisticated, they could say that. But you are right. For some reason, they don't like that argument. And I think it's partly ideological in the sense that they like having the Fed and what it can do, and so that's why the argument about, well, gee, that's redistributing from people and they don't care. I mean, just by that token, how can they tax some people and spend it on other things? You know, that's, in our view, well, if you're Rothbardian, that's you're stealing from one person and giving it to somebody else. You can't do that, but that's not the way the Keynesian's going to analyze it, because then he couldn't say, oh, yeah, I know it's stealing, but I'm for it. He has to say, no, it's not stealing. It's taxation. So, okay, let me stop there, guys, because I have to get ready for the next class. So I will see you. So I'll catch up on the forums. I'll hope to do that later today. Talk to you guys later.